I'm sure all of you can look back on your life and tell the story of when spiritual understanding began to come to you, and the time before you were given the opportunity to learn deep truths, and the time after it, that there was some moment in which your magnetism reached critical mass, and perhaps something you'd been looking at for a long time suddenly seemed interesting to you, or who knows what the possibilities are. A gentleman at Ananda Village told me a story about, I can't remember the entire circumstances, but let's just say his life was a little bit on the down and out. And he was, I believe, in New York City. And he found himself like early in the morning on some street corner of a part of town that was not all that desirable. And he was waiting for a bus or hoping to be rescued from some difficult situation, I don't recall. And he turned around and there was a bookstore that was closed and the shades were drawn except for a strip about 6 inches wide. And what was exposed in that strip was a large poster of Paramahansa Yogananda in which just his eyes were showing. So here's this man on a street corner just completely at sea, at a very low ebb in his life, and he turns around and there are these eyes peering at him from a photograph, but he felt it to be much more than a photograph at the time, just looking at him like this. And of course, one thing led to another, and I was speaking to him at Ananda Village, so you can fill in all the different pieces. I recall friends of ours talking about people who come here, some at different times we've had different posters advertising Ananda, and there was a poster with a big picture of Master again with those luminous eyes. And she was just walking by the East-West bookstore when it was in Menlo Park, and it was just one of those things. She was walking right by and those eyes just spoke to her, and all of a sudden she found herself making a U-turn and coming back in. Swamiji himself talks about having gone to the bookstore looking for things. This was before he met Master, and seeing Master's book, Autobiography of a Yogi, face out with this photograph of Master at the bottom of the cross here, just looking at him and feeling tremendously drawn and picking up the book and opening it. But he was a little still filled with doubts, and the dedication to Autobiography of a Yogi is to Luther Burbank, an American saint. And Swami thought, oh, there's no such thing as an American saint. This materialistic country, nobody could really be saintly. And he shut the book and he put it back on the shelf. But then a few days later, he was on his way to see if he could get a berth on a ship to go out to earn money. He was going to be a sailor and earn money to become a hermit in South America. And he was on his way to do that. And the thought came into his mind of the eyes, Yogananda's eyes, on the cover of that book. And there was this impulse from his heart that said, there's something in there that you really need to, you need to seek that out. And then the war began, which is the war of just this very short distance between this profound longing of the heart and all the reasons of the mind. The mind said, oh, you need to save money now. You're much too intellectual. You shouldn't be reading books. You've been through this. It's time just to get on that ship and earn the money. And he made a decision with his mind that he was going to go in one direction geographically. And all of a sudden, he felt his body turned and his feet being forced to move to go toward that bookstore. It was sort of like Master said to him, enough already. Okay, I've let you reason this out and you're just about to really make a terrible mistake. And he just turned him like that. But also, and then Swami became so thrilled by the conscious experience of a force greater than his own reason. His reason had made one decision, but somehow another decision was made for him, that he rushed to the bookstore and grabbed the book. And he talked about how he was holding it to his heart. He felt that he and Yogananda were already old friends. Now bear in mind, this is 1948. There's absolutely no context for this. It's merely looking into those eyes, having this experience, and from his heart, having this certainty. And then, just to sort of put the period on the sentence, Swamiji describes how he met another young man there. Swami was 22 himself. And this man was, they just graduated from college, and he was making his way in the world, and he starts talking to Swami, this is all in New York City, about the job he's going to get in advertising and how much money he's going to make and how he's really on the pathway to success now and everything's coming up good for him. And Swami talked about how this man's voice and all his materialistic dreams and all this promise of how he was going to live in the world and be an important man and all these things are going to happen. Swami just said he clutched Yogananda's book ever closer to him, and he had this distinct impression that this strange yogi, Swami hadn't even read the book, bear in mind, he'd just seen the picture, that this strange yogi and he were allies. And the two of them were allies against this alien force represented by this very worldly-minded friend of his, and that the two of them together were going to find their way out of this labyrinth of confusion that was human life to him. And of course, Swami read the book. As soon as he finished, he took a bus to Los Angeles. In his first meeting with Yogananda, he was initiated as a disciple and a monk, and the rest is history. But there was that moment in which Swamiji was able to receive that which was there to be given to him. And all of us in our lives, our own spiritual development is this gradual progress to be able to receive that which is there to be given to us. What we have to understand, you see, is that the nature of creation, as we affirm every week in the Festival of Light, we were born for ever-increasing self-awareness. When we've tried so many times when we try to explain what it is we give to our children in our school, because so many words, whenever I write about Ananda, trying to communicate it in ways that are not personal, where there's no possibility of conveying with mere magnetism thoughts that it has to be only words. You know, when you're there in person, you can get away with a lot of things. You'll hear teenagers especially sometimes communicating with each other, and they'll say things like, I mean, it was so like, I mean, how can I put it? It was so wow, oh, I get it, you know. And you look at it, nothing's actually been said. But an enormous amount has been communicated, and even just in words. It was so fabulous, like that. And you understand that something happened. If you write it down, it says, it was so fabulous. It was so fabulous. Well, am I being sarcastic? You don't have any idea. So when you're actually just putting down words, I always feel the rule of thumb for writing about Ananda, because Ananda is utterly unique, is that we have to be able to say things that no one else can say. Because everyone talks about joy and happiness and universality and all these different things, but you have to be able to say things that no one else could say. When our main explanation of Ananda now is, Ananda is a place where an ancient spiritual tradition is made manifest through the blessings of the masters, through the company of like-minded friends, through the self-transforming practice of Kriya Yoga. It says it right there. And you know, no one else can really say it exactly like that with these masters in this place. Well, talking about our educational system without wanting it to look parochial, we realize that one of the concepts is a very simple one. It's a process of increasing awareness. Now, we add to that the fact that awareness can be increased until it embraces infinity. And that's a point of view that self-realization brings into it. If you look even at just raising children, you realize what you're doing is just gradually increasing their awareness. They come in and they can't find their mouths with a spoon. You know, they just don't know anything. I remember this little 2-year-old boy. Well, he was beginning to speak, so maybe he was a little bit older. But he was a friend of mine, and I came into his parents' house, and he was in a moment of supreme increased awareness, and he grabbed me by the hand and absolutely would not let me relate to anyone, just dragged me upstairs to his bedroom and came to his bureau drawer, and he pulled out his bureau drawer, and then he just positively shrieked with joy the word socks, like that, because there were socks in the drawer. And then he pushed the drawer shut, and then he looked at me like, you won't believe this, and he pulled out the drawer again, and there were socks again in the drawer. And it was just like out of the chaos of just being a child and not, you know, being carried here and carried there and handed off to this person and handed off to that person. He'd found a point of consistency. Every time he opened the drawer, there were socks, you know, and it was, you just don't know what little children are trying to do. But we, when we get bigger and can generally find our socks, if we're even slightly orderly about our homes, but it's still, it's the same project, isn't it? Of trying to increase our awareness of what's happening and how to relate to it. And above all, how to relate to it in a way that brings satisfaction and joy to our hearts. The life becomes a battle at a certain point between the omnipresent possibility or fact of suffering and the equally omnipresent longing to be freed from that suffering, to experience joy, even more profoundly than joy, the word bliss, which is, bliss is not just the up and down joy of the waves of feeling, but bliss is that aspect of our own nature. And that's what we're always, with everything we have, that's what we're longing for. And our very nature, the ocean itself, this world was created from the substance of spirit. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was all there is. The Spirit blew across the water and made this creation. We are the same substance as the infinite. Swamiji often has been saying it to us lately, we are as old as God. It's a funny way to put it, but it's sort of fun. You know, we're not children, we're not adults, we're not men or women. We really are not born or die. All those are just waves on the ocean of our true nature. And the nature of the ocean is to try to bring all the waves back into the ocean bosom. And that's, there's this conscious force which is within us, which is appears to be outside of us. We identify with the wave and we feel the ocean pulling us back to itself. And that's the constant flow of life. Life was, you know, with the dawn of life comes the increasing sense of self-awareness. And the battle within us is always when these glimpses of higher awareness come. Do we have the courage to be able to trust what we're seeing and move into that? Or do we cling from habit to all these little rational thoughts that make us wonder about this and wonder about that? Even Swami tells that beautiful story about the first time he picked up Autobiography of a Yogi. He reasoned himself out of reading it. I know myself, the first time I read Autobiography of a Yogi, I think I got to about page 9. Because it's on page 9, the Yogananda's father is walking through a wheat field with one of his employees, and Lahiri Mahashaya just suddenly manifests in the middle of this field of grass and answers a conversation that Yogananda's father has been having with this man. The man was a disciple of Lahiri. He wanted time off from work so he could go visit Lahiri. And Yogananda's father, as his employer, said, "Oh, you're much too, you need to buckle down and work. I'm not going to give you time off just for this frivolous pursuit of the spiritual path." All of a sudden, Lahiri materializes in the wheat field and says his name was Bhagavati. "You're too hard on your employee," he says, like this. I mean, this is, he's just walking down the street, and all of a sudden, bingo, this person he's never seen before materializes on the spot and scolds him for a conversation that he couldn't possibly have overheard. I, as the reader, shut the book. You know, Yogananda's father had the intuitive receptivity to say, "Not only do I give you leave to go see your guru, I'm going with him, with you, and also taking my wife, and we're going to be initiated by this man." Now, you have this wonderful spirit in the culture of India, which understands, has a cultural commitment to the truth of these teachings as a reality. And that's why it's such a joy to offer these teachings in India, because there's this bias in favor of expanded awareness in a spiritual sense. In America, you have a very strong bias in the other direction. You know, our point of view is that we need to be astute. We're always thinking about, you know, what's the angle here? How are they trying to, what are they trying to get from me? What can I get from them? And we have a very great fear of being perceived as being naive or credulous. You know, we always want to be sharp. We always want to be the first one to say, I knew that was a fraud. We don't ever want to be the last one to figure that out. You know, even Swamiji jokes, you go to modern art museums where some of the art is absolutely horrible, and everybody waits to see if somebody of authority likes it, you know, and then you say something astute about it. Very few people can say, that is really ugly, you know, and just stand there all by yourself and say, that's really ugly. Because we want to be sharp. That's our, see, it's our cultural bias. So in this country, you're always having to work with people like this. And the saddest part about America is that people have our cultural biases, that we are very heartfelt. We're very enthusiastic people. You see when you travel around the country, you see Americans, and Americans are very exuberant. You can just sort of see them. You go to many different countries, and for one thing, remember when all the terrorist stuff was so great? They advised Americans when they were going out of this country not to wear white athletic shoes. Because Americans, you could always find them because they were walking around the whole planet in white tennis shoes. You know, and it's true. It's sort of this, you know, we're practical and here we are in our white Adidas or whatever we're walking around in. But you can recognize Americans because they're very enthusiastic and heartfelt and open, and they speak to other people and they expect people to like them, sometimes obnoxiously so, but nonetheless, you know, they expect people to like them and be interested in what we're interested in. So we have that heart. Look, of all the countries in the world, Paramahansa Yogananda came here. America was the country that had the possibility, because the other side of this country is that we're just wide open to accepting everything. We have no history. You know, in business since 1970 is a huge statement. In India, they have businesses that have been going on for 15 generations, you know. And so you have all this past that you have to lug around. In this country, we have nothing. So it makes us wide open to completely innovative things. The way Master put it, Americans have no idea how hard it is to realize God, so we just think we can do it. And because of that, in many ways we can. We have that wonderful heart. But that heart is always balanced by this, what's in it for me, kind of energy. And all these years that I've been teaching now, which has been so, you know, it's been quite a few decades, I'm getting to quite enjoy age. It has this wonderful kind of freedom in it that I've been doing certain things for quite a long time, and I can speak with a certain amount of experience, if nothing else. So many people are so deeply touched by Master, by Swamiji, by Ananda, by a book, by a song, by a piece of music. And I see it in their eyes. You know, I have this wonderful view. I have the best view in the house. David and I have the best view in the house. You all do get to see the pictures of the Masters, which perhaps is better. But I don't know, because I get to see all of you looking this way at those pictures and feel your receptivity. Yet on the day that Swamiji left, which was Tuesday, it was in the middle of the day, and word went out very casually, and some people gathered as we came out of our house and got in the car to drive away. And there were lots of people, always have cameras, and they take these pictures of Swamiji, and I didn't have a camera. I was standing next to him, and I really wanted to photograph this direction because the heartfelt appreciation and receptivity in people's eyes was really a clearer picture of Swamiji than the picture of Swami's face, because what we were looking at was people receiving inspiration and having the courage to be open to receive it. And that's what I watch all the time. And then people will come to me and they'll talk to me about how much this means to them, how everything in their life is different. And the same stories, you can all tell those stories, I can tell those stories, and they'll never see them again. Just there, and then they went away. And sometimes 10 years later, he'll come back. And it's always, I don't know what happened, but the mind began to doubt. somebody told me, oh, it's not what you think it is. Oh, it's a cult. Oh, there was a lawsuit against them. Oh, how don't you know? And then all of a sudden this great fear of, oh, I've got to appear astute. You know, I don't want to be too, like, taken advantage of. And then we just take the heart and go like that. This tremendous commitment to hear. But this is the reality, and every one of us knows it. I'm not talking about emotions. I'm not talking about getting all just charged up and riding the wave down. I'm talking about that much deeper reality that causes you to turn around and see those pictures, just those eyes peeking out of that bookstore. Something in you says, I know. I didn't have that with autobiography. The first time I had that with Swami Kriyananda. He just walked in. That was it. And by that time, I was a little bit like Swami in the same way. I could tell that this mind, really, really clever though it was, could just take me any direction at all, and it did not have a rudder. You know, it could just go anywhere it wanted to go, but there was no rudder. Swamiji said from when he was born, he used to play with logic, is how he put it. He used to use his clever mind to prove any point he wanted to prove. And he could see how easily the mind could prove any point it wanted to prove. And even as a child, he said, he wouldn't accept anything as true unless it felt right. Yes, the heart can also mislead you if it, instead of being calm intuition, it is merely emotion or prejudice, you know, based on fear. I recall I've shared with you the most important exchange I ever had with Swamiji was when I was very emotionally trying to understand God's will. And I found it so difficult to understand God's will. And I said, oh, Swami, this is just weeping. This is me as 24 years old, just weeping. Oh, it's so hard to know what God wants. And I'm sobbing in this very theatrical way that I had. And I said, so hard to know what God wants. Swami said, no, it's not. I mean, he didn't put any more energy into it than that. He just said, no, it's not. And that's all he said to me. And I had to just dry my eyes and walk away because he wasn't going to converse anymore. I mean, he wasn't freezing me out, but the conversation was over. And I thought to myself, well, it's very hard for me to know what God wants. He can do it because... But then I thought, no, he didn't say, it's easy for me to know. He just said, it's not hard to know. So I asked myself, why is it hard for me? The answer was really simple. Because I don't want to know. Whoa, because if I just settled deep into myself, it's very clear to me. But then I have all these things I want and don't want, and I'm afraid of this and I'm afraid of that, and what if this happens and what if that happens? All of that just wants to silence that still small voice that just says, put one foot in front of the other. You know, we don't know where we're going. If people think they know where they're going, they're just kidding themselves. You don't know in the next moment where you'll be. All we ever have is the now. There's this reality, one of the principles of Ananda, and it's a very profound one. It's an ancient Sanskrit saying, where there is dharma, there is victory. Where there is right consciousness and right action, everything will come out in the way it's meant to come out. And many times in my own life and in other people's lives, I've seen it. You have no idea where that dharma is leading you. You don't really know how all the pieces are going to fit together. And a lot of times your mind says, but you can't do that because of this. You can't do that because of this. But where there is dharma, there is victory. And over many painful mistakes, you gradually figure out, I have no idea what the next step is, but this is the right step for now. And as soon as you take that step, everything in the whole universe has shifted. And then you'll know what it is that you need to do next. And this is the truth of the intuitive self. Don't worry about, I mean, everybody worries about everything. I've just sort of tried to make it a practice lately. What is there to worry about? Everything always works out one way or another, either well or badly. But all of the anxiety ahead of time, what difference does it make? When it is, it is. And how can you possibly know? Because by the time you're standing there, everything in all of creation is different. But each step of the way, what is Dharma? Dharma is that action which takes you toward greater awareness. That courageous action which moves us toward our divine goal. Live that way. That's when this teachings come to us. Our reading today was about swine and dogs and not to give the spiritual teaching to such souls because they'll cast it aside. Well, I've reversed it the other way. What do we need to do in order to draw that spiritual opportunity to us? We need to receive it in the spirit in which it's given, and even much more profoundly, have the courage to use it. Live in the light, move in the light. Where there is Dharma, there is victory. There is fulfillment, there is bliss, and by no other path will that which we seek be given to us.